वासुदेवाया
भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय.
So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, the 10th canto, the Saman Bonum. Chapter 71, The Lord Travels to Indraprastha. And today we're doing text number 7. Yes, 7. Brahmaveshadaro gatva
Brahmaveshadaro gatva
Tam viksheta vrikodara
Tam viksheta vrikodara
Aneshati na sandeho
Aneshati na sandeho
Vairathe tava sanidau
Vairathe tava sanidau
Ramavesha daro gatva
Ramavesha daro gatva
Vikseta vrikodara
Vikseta vrikodara
Anishati na sandeho
Anishati na sandeho
Vairathe tava sanidau
Vairathe tava sanidau
Brahmavesha daro gatva
Brahmavesha daro gatva
Vikseta vrikodara
Vikseta vrikodara
Anishati na sandeho
Anishati na sandeho
Vairathe tava sanidau
Vairathe tava sanidau Viksheta should beg. Vrika udara bhima. Hanishati he will kill him. Na no. Sandeha doubt. Vairathe in one-on-one chariot combat. Tava your Sanidao in the presence. Translation of her book by the followers of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
Bhima should go to him disguised as a Brahmana and beg charity. Thus he will obtain single combat with Jarasandha, and in your presence Bhima will no doubt kill him. Responsibly. Bhima should go to him disguised as a Brahmana. And beg charity. Thus he will obtain single combat with Jarasandha. And in your presence, Bhima will no doubt kill him. Purport. The idea is that Bhima should go and should beg as charity a one-on-one fight with Jarasandha. Text 8. Even Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva act only as your instruments in cosmic creation and annihilation, which are ultimately done by you, the Supreme Lord, in your invisible aspect of time. Purport. Uddhava here explains, in fact, that Lord Krishna... Uddhava here explains that, in fact, Lord Krishna himself will cause the death of Jarasandha, and Bhima will merely be an instrument. The Supreme Lord, through his invisible potency of time, creates and annihilates the entire cosmic situation, whereas great demigods such as Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva are merely the instruments of the Lord's will. Therefore, Bhima will have no difficulty acting as the Lord's instrument to kill the powerful Jarasandha. In this way, by the Lord's arrangement, his devotee Bhima will be glorified. Om Gyanatam Nandasya Gnanjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasari Gaur Bhakti Vrinda.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare,
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. So continuing with the pastime of a lila of Lord Krishna arranging for, well, going with Bhima and Arjuna to finally vanquish Jarasandha. Jarasandha was a great king, very powerful, but he was irreligious. He was selfishly motivated. And he was causing so many problems to so many people. So in this particular conversation, we have Uddhava, cousin of Krishna and also the dear friend and advisor, is offering his advice. Krishna asked Uddhava to give his advice. Later, this would strike Uddhava's heart that although Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead, who knows everything perfectly, still he asked my advice. Very mysterious. Why would he do such a thing? Normally, we ask advice because we are in ignorance about something. For Krishna, that's not the case. How can the omniscient, all-knowing person be in ignorance about anything? So therefore, the conclusion is that he did so simply as part of his play in this world. You see, people have many different conceptions about the Absolute Truth. Many people think that God or the Supreme is simply energy, impersonal, formless energy. And then it takes the shape of the world, and it takes the shape of people, and thoughts and emotions and experiences. In this way, the world is formed out of energy. But ultimately, everything is one. Just like when we die, our bodies return to the earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So does the animating force, the spirit, that returns to the greater spirit. And ultimately, people think, you know, that the supreme is a homogeneous substance. Homogeneous, you know that word? We used to they have milk. That's homogeneous. You see the blue top. When I was a child, we used to get milk in glass bottles. And my mother would insist on getting silver top. And also, she'd get like a crate of silver top bottles. And then she'd get at least one green top. Green top means trim milk. And that was for her. Because she was very concerned about remaining petite. Anyway, we'd get the full cream milk, and this was unhomogenized. Mm-hmm. There was cream sitting on the top, a layer about that thick, and then there was the milk. So there was some distinction, there was distinct elements in the milk. And then they've pretty much phased that out. I don't even know if you can get silver top milk anymore. I don't know in this country whether you can get it. Generally it's just homogenized. What is that? They take it and they blend it up. And it becomes one. It just becomes one homogeneous substance. So Prabhupada uses that word a lot. Can I have some water? To explain the impersonalist conception of the absolute truth, that it's all just one, that ultimately all energy will be blended up and become this one force without personality, without desire. It just exists, just is. And because it's one, it doesn't really do anything. There's no distinction, there's no activity. So people, many times, they think about the Supreme or God, they think about it in that term, in those terms. But the Vedas say this is not a complete understanding. Sure, everything is made out of energy. This we can understand practically. Even the quantum physicists, they understand that these days, that if you break things down, you know, you've got these small building blocks, electrons and protons and all that sort of stuff at a very minute level, and everything is made out of this one substance. But actually what they do is they think they tend to, it breaks down further and further and further, and it gets more and more complex. But in any case, the conception is there that everything is energy. But the question is, and we should definitely consider and ask ourselves, how is it that this one energy takes on form of so many varieties? How is it that, you know, in, right now, we're all sitting in this room together, and we each have our own consciousness, our own awareness, our own thoughts and desires, our own senses, our own personalities, and we're discussing. And you know, there's different feelings and experiences and so forth going on. How did the oneness become like this? So the impersonalists, they'll say that what happens is the oneness started dreaming or fell into illusion or something. Actually, they can't explain it. And then all the personalities came out. So this obviously doesn't really answer anything. How come we're all individuals? So Lord Chaitanya especially, he explained that actually the true situation is achincha bheda abheda tattva, that everything is simultaneously one, all connected, and born of the same fundamental source, yet there's also difference there. There's variety. And in the ultimate sense, this means that actually God has form, personality. And we exist as eternally parts and parcels of the Supreme. And there's a relationship. There's a relationship between the soul and there's a relationship between the soul and God. And in that relationship, you see that devotees, devotee means like everyone's devoted to something ultimately. Whether it just be themselves, it might just be their own whimsical desires, but they're devoted in the fact that they're serving. But devotees in the transcendental sense means those who have devoted their entire life and everything that that means, their senses, their energy, their mind, their heart, their thinking, feeling and willing capacity, they've devoted that to the service of God. What does that mean? Just the oneness? No, it means to the personality of God, the person, Krishna. Krishna is very beautiful. In Bhagavad Gita, he explains that everything that we see in this world that is beautiful, wonderful, amazing, this comes from a small spark of his opulence, of his beauty, of his majesty. So all the wonderful expressions of nature, you know, the beautiful sunsets, the awe-inspiring mountain ranges, the thunderstorms that shake your bones. All these things are just a tiny spark of the power, beauty, and variety that exists within the Supreme Person. So Krishna's form contains all beauty, all knowledge, all fame, all renunciation, all strength, etc. He is the abode of all wonderful qualities. Therefore, he's called Krishna, the all-attractive. And devotees become attracted and devoted to serving this personality. This is the reason for this whole temple, actually. You have here, we don't just have the altar opens up and then there's like this white light. There's this really white, bright white light shining in your eyes. And then there's just Ultimately, if you take the impersonal philosophy to its final, you draw it out and follow the train of logic to its final point, there's no reason to do anything. There's no justifiable reason to even act or exist or even open your mouth and talk to somebody. Because it's all one, you are me, I am you. You know, whether we're facing east or west, north or south, it doesn't really make any difference. Whether I embrace you or kill you doesn't make any difference, because it's all one ultimately, and this is just a big illusion. It doesn't matter if I worship Coca-Cola or Hare Krishna. This is the conclusion of the impersonalist conception. But no, that's not the case, actually. The Supreme is the all-attractive person, and the nature of the soul, is to serve and love God, Krishna, the personality of Godhead. And you know that because it feels so natural. When you do it, you feel so at peace, so satisfied in devotional service. Simply trying to worship something all-pervasive, unlimited, without beginning or end, without form, to fall in love with such an idea, it's impossible, because there's nothing for the mind to fasten on. We have senses, we have a mind, and everything in our experience is specific. There is no abstract existence. Okay, so what we're reading here is this is in Bhagavatam, 10th canto. So, as we heard on the weekend, the Bhagavatam was spoken to Maharaj Parikshit, who was cursed to die in 7 days due to an offence he caused. It was mysterious how he actually caused an offence, because actually he was a saintly devotee. But anyway, by the power of Yogamaya, his consciousness was covered, and he caused an offence to a sage by wrapping a snake around his neck. And then he was cursed to die by this sage's son, who was furious at such disrespect of his father. So he sat down on the bank of the Ganges, renounced his kingdom, handed it over to his son, and proceeded to hear Bhagavatam. Shukadeva Goswami came and instructed him in Bhagavatam. And you know, Maharaj Parikshit, he asked, what is the duty of all people? What is the ultimate thing? What are we really supposed to be doing in this life? It's a perennial question that besets the living entity. What to do? Some people, failing to find an answer to this question, they become depressed. They find despair. What's the point of it all? They get depressed, and some people even kill themselves out of despair of the seeming pointlessness of existence. or other people, they just act, you know, impelled by desires, and tend to get themselves into a mess, personally and also society in general. You can see there's so many imbalances in the world today because people don't know ultimately what to do. How should I be acting? How should I be living? You know, these days, you know, people think it's a very liberated time, you know, because there's free love. You can get everything and more on the internet that you ever want. You know, everything's politically correct. You shouldn't have to offer respects to anybody in particular. Everybody's equal. You know, men and women are exactly the same. There's no difference between the genders. It's a kind of making of everything. Everything's all one. And there's no need for religion or spirituality. It's simply that you do whatever you want. So people don't know what to do in this situation. What do I do? The traditions have been smashed. There should be no tradition anymore because they just shackle the contemporary human being. Why follow an old tradition? Why not just do whatever you want? Just do it. If it feels good, do it. So this is the philosophy of the modern day. But what happens is everybody has their own lusts and greeds, and their senses are hungry. So everybody is trying to get as much of the world as they can for themselves, and accumulating so many, addictions, dependencies, and in this way they actually damage themselves, degrade themselves through too much indulgence and ignorant living, and the society in general becomes degraded as well, because nobody knows what to do ultimately. So the highest authority becomes the senses, the appetites, the animal appetites. The only thing that everyone can agree on is that there should be money, and lots of it. So somehow or other, you know, make money. You know, we should just, whatever it takes, cut down the forests and sell them. Just make money for these people at in this nation at this time. Don't worry so much about the future. So of course this is a real problem. People don't know what to do. So Maharaj Pariksit, he asks, what is actually the duty of every living being? What is the proper way to act? And what is the purpose of the whole thing anyway? This whole mysterious phenomenon called life. What is it all about actually? We find ourselves existing with appetites. Most people just say, okay, I have my appetites, so let me try and fulfill them, not knowing that the appetites can never be fulfilled. But, you know, the intelligent person, the real awakened human being, will begin to ask, what is this life? Where did it come from? What is the function of it? And what is the ultimate goal? What is the ultimate destination? So Maharaj Pariksit was asking this question, and he said, especially, tell me this, what is the duty of somebody who's about to die? Very wonderful questions. For the benefit of everyone, actually. He was not just asking for himself. Saintly people, they don't do that. They're not selfish. He was asking for the benefit of everyone, because it was a large assembly. People knew this is a great saintly devotee king, and this is a great sage, enlightened sage. What the conversation that will go on between them, that will be very amazing, very enlightening. And many of us know that transcendental knowledge, when you hear discourses on Bhagavad Gita, when you hear Krishna conscious knowledge, it's so tasty, it's so satisfying. It's like when you first read Prabhupada's books and he's going for it, just you know, smashing the illusions that we all have. You know, it's just like, yeah, it's nectar, it's so tasty. So relishable, because it's real, it's really real, and it strikes a chord of intuition within us. It's like, I knew that, kind of, vaguely I knew that, because when I hear it, I'm just like, yes, that is true, I have no doubt, I am not this body, I am spirit soul. These kind of things, they strike deep, and they awaken, yes, that makes sense, now I understand. So many people assembled to hear the conversation between Maharaj Pariksit and Sukadeva Goswami. So he was asking the question for everyone. So Bhagavatam proceeds through the conversation, you know, talks about many activities throughout the history of this universe and even other universes, in past ages, in past creations, because the universe gets created and destroyed in constant cycles. And he talked about all the famous people. Not the famous people in the relative sense, like they made some catchy pop song and they're handsome, so you worship them. No, not people like that, you know, but people who were enlightened. People who are eternally glorious. Because even the rich and famous and the beautiful, their fame fades. You know, the musician comes out with his first album, wow, great, worship, worship. Second album, that's alright. Third album, anyway. Or the beautiful star fades in time. Beauty fades in time. Or the fashions change and people are no longer interested in their offering. No, but the devotees in the Bhagavatam, the personalities in the Bhagavatam, they are eternally glorious because they exist in relationship to the eternal reality. Therefore their existence becomes substantial. It becomes real. Otherwise we're just like otherwise the conditioned soul is just a passing dream, like a cloud formation in the sky that's there 1 minute and then gone. And they're just acting completely engrossed in the illusion of this temporary world. But the enlightened soul, they're awakened and they exist and they perform activities not in relation to the body and the mind, the temporary body and mind, but in relation to the absolute truth. And they demonstrate by their activities, by their consciousness, by their words, the enlightened state. And then by studying that, we can begin to understand what it means to be an enlightened devotee. So many, many histories are told of the creation and structure of the universe, the dissolution, the different ages. So many things. Bhagavatam goes through many, many cantos. And finally we arrive at the 10th canto. And the 10th canto is known as the Summum Bonum. Who knows what that means? It's a Latin term. Huh? The conclusion, yeah. The highest conclusion. So what is the highest conclusion? What do we think? What would be the highest expression of the absolute truth? Yeah, I mean, we know that because... But if you're just conceptualizing, you're sitting there, you know, around the campfire, you know, and with your, you know, maybe with a bit of herbal assistance, you know. I used to do this type of thing, you know, you sit down... And then you speculate, what's the supreme like? Inevitably people come to this idea, it must be that homogeneous oneness. That's the highest expression, and the highest destination will be just when I don't exist anymore as a person, but I just kind of merge into this oneness and do nothing forever. That's the highest thing they can come up with. No, Bhagavatam takes our vision so much higher. Krishna, the personality of Godhead, a cowherd boy in Vrindavan, peacock feather in his hair, all beautiful, so charming, so sweet, and all the relationships he has with his devotees in the form of his mother, his father, his friends, the gopis of Vrindavan who are completely in love with him, the cowherd girls, young cowherd girls, completely in love with him, and all his amazing activities of playing in the forest, of destroying demons sent by Kamsa to kill him, of herding cows in the beautiful forest setting. So that is one sort of part. That is the early life of Krishna. And then Krishna, when he's 12 or 16, he goes to Mathura and kills Kamsa, who's been persecuting him and the residents of Vrindavan for his whole life. And then he becomes, you know, a city man, like a king. And gradually establishes his reputation as a king, or as a ruler, and has his fortress in Dwarka. So we've passed through the whole story of Krishna's life. And devotees, rather than just trying to focus on the oneness, the bright light, the formless, they've absorbed themselves in these pastimes, meditate them on them, and become very attracted to them. This is devotional life. Just like we chant Hare Krishna, it's a name, and we chant that name with love and devotion, and we become more and more attached to it. And in the experience of love and devotion is great satisfaction. Everybody knows, everybody loves to be in love. Even though the love of this world tends to be fleeting, and after a while we realize, hang on, that was all just a projection of my mind. But in devotional life, we fall in love, and we love that experience of being attracted. So this is Krishna consciousness. Falling in love with the personality of Godhead, becoming a devotee. So here, today we're hearing about Uddhava's explaining that what you should do is go and pick a fight from Jarasandha, and Bhima will be able to kill him, undoubtedly, because he is in your presence. And then he says that actually, the living beings, your devotees, they act with the understanding that their strength is completely contingent upon your mercy. We think we're acting in this world, we think we're moving the energy of this world. You know, this is my hand, and I move it. Right? Of course, makes sense. But what is this hand ultimately? You know, we said it was energy. We ate something, the hand grew eventually. So basically, this hand's made out of food. And the food, as we break that down, that's actually energy. So this body of ours, this mind of ours, this is energy. Is it our energy? One day when the soul leaves this body, we won't be able to move it anymore. This is not even our energy. We can't even move the energy of this world, not even our own hand, without the sanction of God, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The super soul is within the heart, detecting the desire of the living being. And then it's the super soul actually that moves the hand, that makes things happen in the world, according to the desire of the living being, through the agency of the demigods. It's complex, but still, we have no power actually to move this world at all. It's simply the mercy of the super soul. So the devotee understands this. Actually, for example, you go out on book distribution, there's a book distribution marathon at the moment, and you're giving books to people and you're hoping that by your efforts, this person will become elevated, they'll become awakened, they'll see the light, so to speak, and they'll begin their real life, their awakened life as a devotee, rather than just living in the dream. They wake up, sleeping soul. You're hoping that will happen. But what power do you have to change somebody's heart or somebody's mind? What power do you have to start in them a complete existential revolution from I am the controller and enjoyer of the energy of this world to I am the servant of God? What power do you actually have to do that? By your arguments you think you can do that? By your logic, by your presentation, by your singing power? You can't do that. That has to be the super soul within their heart. So the devotee understands this. The devotee, therefore, understanding that, doesn't just become inactive. Oh, well, I can't do anything anyway. I'm just a jiva. I'm not the controller. Therefore, I won't do anything. No, the devotee endeavors with great enthusiasm. And what is the main endeavor? How to clean my heart of selfish motivations. How to make my heart pure. So all I want to do is give pleasure to Krishna. how can I fulfill the desires of Krishna to deliver and wake up the conditioned souls of the material world in the material world? That is Lord Chaitanya's desire, actually. So the devotee endeavors with great determination, but at the same time remains detached. I try my best and leave the result up to Krishna. This is the freedom from stress formula. Sometimes you go out on books and say, have you heard of stress? Huh? And the person says, no. Everybody says, yeah, of course I've heard of stress. They say, oh, you don't look stressed. Anyway, these books talk about how we can completely escape stress. So in one sense, it's very light. It's very light and universal kind of principle. It's not particularly deep or spiritual. And you might think, how does all this philosophy and these stories, how does that actually ultimately free us from stress? The answer is by this principle. Understanding the nature of the world, understanding the nature of our existence, and the devotee becomes perfect in his consciousness that he knows, I am simply the trier. I am not the doer, I am the trier. Krishna is the doer, he will make everything happen. So therefore I do my best to act in loving devotion according to my temporary body and mind, the nature, and I use whatever intelligence and strength I have. But it's simply an offering. Devotional life is spiritual 24 hours a day, even though we're doing so many different activities. Ultimately we're doing one thing, and that's offering our very existence to the Lord. So the devotee does that, simply offers, and then if it turns out good, if it turns out bad, the devotee, that's not my responsibility. Now I'll leave it up to the Lord. So on book distribution, you go out, you try your best. Use whatever intelligence you've been given to reach a person, to inspire them, to take an interest. But ultimately you understand it all actually depends on the will of the Lord. And this way we're free from stress. We are able to act dynamically with no anxiety. This is the boon of the devotional understanding. So Uddhava is explaining, Bhima will go and he will fight with Jarasandha, and you know they've both got the strength of 10,000 elephants, so it'll be a fair fight. But what will make the difference, Krishna, is that you will be there and you want Bhima to win. Why do you want Bhima to win? Because Jarasandha is a demon, for example. Bhima is a devotee, and also Jarasandha is going to obstruct Yudhisthira's desire to perform the Rajasuriya sacrifice. It's very interesting. Yudhisthira wanted to perform the Rajasuriya sacrifice to give honor to Krishna. And Krishna wanted to help him do that simply because he desired to do it. So this is love, actually. Krishna wanted to help Yudhisthira fulfill his desire, and Yudhisthira simply wanted to glorify Krishna. So they cooperated like that. Interesting, eh? So this will make the difference, that Krishna is there at the fight, and therefore Bhima will surely be victorious over Jarasandha. Okay, any questions or comments on these points? Yes?
What's the Rajasuri sacrifice? Surya, son of Raja.
Raja, king.
King. What does it entail?
It's like a huge Vedic sacrifice. Yeah. It's like on a massive scale. And I'm not exactly sure about all the details. But only the king of the world can perform it. Only one who's conquered the entire world, or has the entire world in submission, can actually perform that sacrifice. In Yudhisthira's sacrifice, even the demigods will come. And then there's a big argument about who should be the presiding deity over the festival. It's not over the sacrifice. Who should be the supreme personality? Who should be honored as the highest? Because even the demigods are there. This was Shishupala's argument. Everybody wanted to honor Krishna. But Shishupala couldn't stand that because he was envious of Krishna. He said, no, there's so many greater personalities. Who is this Krishna? We don't even know his Varna. Is he a cowherd boy? Is he a king? Who knows? He's dubious. And he also committed so many offences. So it's a very great performance. You know, that you have the brahmanas chanting mantras, offerings into the fire. I was thinking about that. I don't actually know very much about him. I know he was the spiritual master of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's. And he had a very avidut kind of style. You know, he would live very privately. Very humble, didn't want fame or glory. When he got a reputation as a great devotee, people would come to him. So he'd go and hide in like the stool field. Nobody would come there. It said that he even ate out of a human skull. Different things he did. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wanted to take initiation from him. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was a great scholar, super intelligent. Right from a very young age, I think. At the age of 7 years old, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur could recite the whole Bhagavad Gita and give elaborate purports. So he wanted to take initiation from Gaur Kishore Das Babaji. And Gaur Kishore Das Babaji said, no, you're a great scholar, it's very simple, you know. I think maybe he was even illiterate. Not sure about that, but... So he was refusing repeatedly. And eventually, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he just said, well, if you won't accept me, then my life is worthless, and I'll give up this life. So finally, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji accepted him as his disciple. I think he was his only disciple. I think. If there's any corrections on that, you can... Yeah, so that's you have Srila Prabhupada, and then you have Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who's Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master. And here you have Bhakti Vinod Thakur, who was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's Baba. And then on Prabhupada's Vyasa, today it was Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, who is the spiritual master of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So this is the parampara, the line of spiritual masters. And then, you know, Prabhupada, he has many disciples and they are our spiritual masters. So that's how the parampara, the spiritual knowledge descends. That's how the tradition maintains its purity.
Just to add, Nityananda teaching to his very famous master, the Reverend, he's the inductor of skull. And all the people who climb to the Himalayas to approach the Reverend, they're sort of meeting out of the skull. So one disciple was greater than others, and he said, but how can we eat from this skull? And he lifted the skull and he said, look, it's beautiful, it's clean. He said, have you ever seen your own thoughts or have you lost that? So he actually accepted him as a disciple. That was his point of enlightenment.
Any other questions or comments or corrections? Alright, thank you very much. Kontra Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Jai.